Penguin Random House Audio presents I Am, I Am, I Am. 17 Brushes with Death by Maggie O'Farrell. Read for you by Daisy Donovan.
From the Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. I took a deep breath and listened to the old brag of my heart. I am, I am, I am.
Neck, 1990. On the path ahead, stepping out from behind a boulder, a man appears. We are, he and I, on the far side of a dark tarn that lies hidden in the bowl-curved summit of this mountain. The sky is a milky blue above us. No vegetation grows this far up, so it is just me and him, the stones and the still black water. He straddles the narrow track with both booted feet, and he smiles. I realise several things. That I passed him earlier further down the glen. We greeted each other in the amiable yet brief manner of those on a country walk. That on this remote stretch of path there is no one near enough to hear me call. That he has been waiting for me. He has planned this whole thing, carefully, meticulously, and I have walked into his trap. I see all this in an instant. This day, a day on which I nearly die, began early for me, just after dawn, my alarm clock leaping into a rattling dance beside the bed. I had to pull on my uniform, leave the caravan, and tiptoe down some stone steps into a deserted kitchen, where I flicked on the ovens, the coffee machines, the toasters, where I sliced 5 large loaves of bread, filled the kettles, folded 40 paper napkins into open-petaled orchids. I have just turned 18, and I have pulled off an escape. From everything. Home, school, parents, exams, the waiting for results. I have found a job, far away from everyone I know, in what is advertised as a holistic alternative retreat at the base of a mountain. I serve breakfast, I clear away breakfast, I wipe tables. I remind guests to leave their keys. I go into the rooms, I make the beds. I change the sheets, I tidy. I pick up clothes and towels and books and shoes and essential oils and meditation mats from the floor. I learn from the narratives inherent in possessions left strewn around the bedrooms that people are not always what they seem. The rather sententious, exacting man who insists on a specific table, certain soap, and entirely fat-free milk, has a penchant for cloud-soft cashmere socks and exuberantly patterned silk underwear. The woman who sits at dinner with her precisely buttoned blouse and lowered eyelids and growing-out perm has a nocturnal avatar who will don S&M outfits of an equestrian bent, human bridles, tiny leather saddles, a slender but vicious silver whip. The couple from London, who seem wonderingly, enviably perfect. They hold manicured hands over dinner. They take laughing walks at dusk. They show me photos of their wedding. Have a room steeped in sadness, in hope, in grief. Ovulation kits clutter their bathroom shelves. Fertility drugs are stacked on their nightstands. These I don't touch, as if to impart the message, I didn't see this. I am not aware. I know nothing. All morning, I sift and organise and ease the lies of others. I clear away human traces, erasing all evidence that they have eaten, slept, made love, argued, washed, worn clothes, read newspapers, shed hair and skin and bristle and blood and toenails. I dust. I walk the corridors, trailing the vacuum cleaner behind me on a long leash. Then, around lunchtime, if I'm lucky, I have 4 hours before the evening shift to do whatever I want. So I have walked up to the lake, as I often do during my time off, and today, for some reason, I have decided to take the path right around to the other side. Why? I forget. Maybe I finished my tasks earlier that day. Maybe the guests had been less untidy than usual, and I'd got out of the guest house before time. Maybe the clear, sunbright weather has lured me from my usual path. I have also had no reason at this point in my life to distrust the countryside. I have been to self-defence lessons held at the community centre in the small Scottish seaside town where I spent my teens. The teacher, a barrel-shaped man in a judo suit, would put scenarios to us with startling Gothic relish. "Late at night, and you're coming out of a pub," he would say, eyeing us one by one from beneath his excessively sprouting eyebrows, "and a huge bloke lunges out from an alleyway and grabs you. Or, you're in a narrow corridor in a nightclub, and some drunk shoves you up against a wall. Or, it's dark, it's foggy. You're waiting at the traffic lights, and someone seizes your bag strap and pushes you to the ground." These narratives of peril always ended with the same question, put to us with slightly gloating rhetoric. "So, what do you do?" We practiced reversing our elbows into the throats of our imaginary assailants, rolling our eyes as we did so, because we were, after all, teenage girls. We took it in turns to rehearse the loudest shout we could. We repeated dutifully, dully, the weak points in a male body. Eye, nose, throat, groin, knee. We believed we had it covered, that we could take on the lurking stranger, the drunk assailant, the bag-snatching mugger. We were sure we'd be able to break their grip, bring up our knee, scratch at their eyes with our nails. We reckoned we could find an exit out of these alarming yet oddly thrilling synopses. We were taught to make noise, to attract attention, to yell, "Police!" We also, I think, imbibed a clear message. Alleyway, nightclub, pub, bus stop, traffic lights. The danger was urban. In the country or in rural towns like ours, where there were no nightclubs, no alleyways, and no traffic lights even, things like this did not happen. We were free to do as we pleased. And yet here is this man, high up a mountain, blocking my way, waiting for me. It seems important not to show my fear, to play along. So I keep walking, keep putting one foot in front of the other. If I turn and run, he could catch up with me in seconds, and there would be something so exposing, so final about running. It would uncover to us both what the situation is. It would bring things to a head. The only option seems to be to carry on, to pretend that this is perfectly normal. "Hello again," he says to me, and his gaze slides over my face, my body, my bare muddy legs. It is a glance more assessing than lascivious, more calculating than lustful. It is the look of a man working something out, planning the logistics of a deed. I cannot meet his gaze. I cannot look at him directly. Not quite. But I am aware of narrow-set eyes, a considerable height, ivory-coloured incisors, fists gripping his rucksack straps. I have to clear my throat to say, "Hi." I think I nod. I turn myself sideways so as to step past him. A sharp mix of fresh sweat, leather from his rucksack, some kind of chemical heavy shaving oil that seems distantly familiar. I am past him. I am walking away. The path is open before me. He has, I note, chosen for his ambush the apex of the hike. I have climbed and climbed, and it is at this point that I will start to descend the mountain. To my guest house, to my evening shift, to work, to life. It's all downhill from here. I am careful to use strides that are confident, purposeful, but not frightened. I am not frightened. I say this to myself over the oceanic roar of my pulse. Perhaps I think I am free. Perhaps I have misread the situation. Perhaps it's perfectly normal to lie in wait for young girls on remote paths and then...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?